We've had some really interesting topics and discussions over the last number of years. Some of you can attest to that. And we're happy that we've been able to do that and participate and be involved with that. Tonight may be one of the most interesting topics that we've ever tried to tackle. Certainly will be one of the more controversial ones, I guess, outside of the Second Amendment. But we would ask all of you to be civil and courteous tonight to our speakers and guests. This is not designed to be an anti-Mormon bash. So if you came with that intention, you'll probably be I've got the chief of police, Brian Gulliam, on my speed dial. He's a good friend of mine, so he could be here in just a matter of seconds. I need to make an apology, first of all. I sent out the original email, and I got someone, and she may be here tonight, that I offended, because the link to the Glenn L. Pace document that we're going to touch on a little bit, and some of you have seen it, some of you haven't, was taken off of an... I should have just copied it, I suppose, and pasted it, but I was in a hurry, and so I didn't, and it was linked. The link to it went to an anti-Mormon website, okay? So I apologize to you for that. It was not intentional. It was not malice aforethought, et cetera, et cetera. But when you go home and check your email that I sent you, you'll see that. But just look at the document, the 12 pages or whatever it is, and you can ignore all the rest, okay? Otherwise, Google it and research it for yourself, however you want to do it. Okay, let me just do a disclaimer that the views expressed here tonight may not necessarily be those of the staff and management, including Dan and I, even if I say them. So so I would invite you just to take everything, you know, that you hear. We would invite you to study this out on your own. We're trying to find truth. We understand the subject may be hard to absorb tonight because of its evil nature, but as Patrick Henry said, quote, "For my part, whatever anguish of spirit it may cost, I'm willing to know the truth, the whole truth, and to know the worst and provide for it," unquote. So Ken Bowers is a lifelong member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He went on a mission to southern Brazil, has six children. He wrote a book, Hiding in Plain Sight. He's brought a few copies here tonight after studying 35 years on the subject. He worked with and was a protege of Dr. W. Cleon Skousen on several writing projects, and Ken's researched the New World Order, the Illuminati, secret combinations, etc., for several decades. And while he has studied and touched on SRA, he's never actually ever spoken on it. And so he and I had a discussion. He said, "Yeah, I know about it. Never spoken on it. Never really wanted to." But he said, as a favor to me, I guess he'd come out of the closet on it. So this may be the first and perhaps the only time that he'll address this issue. We have a guest panel of experts as well. I've got some little tiny short bios here. And they're going to introduce themselves a little bit more, tell you a little bit more about their stories when we get to that point a little bit later on. Sharon Reese, the first here on my left, is a mother of five, survivor of satanic ritual abuse from the age of 3 to 9. In 1991, she was diagnosed with PTSD, and in 1995, dissociative identity disorder. She's the author of a book called Healing Broken Wings, Alternative Recovery Options for Survivors of PTSD and DID and Ritualistic Abuse, and she composed and sang songs that promoted healing in a CD entitled Healing My Wings. Next to her is Dr. Judy Moore. Short bio here that I've got is experience with treating survivors of SRA. Okay, next to her is Christy Greenouch, and she's a survivor of ritual abuse within the Mormon community. Next to her is Judy Byington, MSW, LCSW, and has dedicated her life to humanizing and raising public awareness about the little-known effects of ritual abuse and mind-controlling programs that typically, tragically, cause formation of multiple personalities in children. She authored a biography of the only known survivor, intended victim of a human sacrificial ceremony, MKUltra mind control survivor Jenny Hill. The book's called 22 Faces, and you can get it at 22faces.com, and that's 22faces.com. She has a new book coming out called Saints, Sinners, and Satan. Encompasses a first-person account of her own experiences with multiple personality survivors and satanic crime. Next to her, we have Chris Anderson, who attended BYU. She's worked with SRA victims. She uncovered a satanic occult with dozens of professional people, including the police and others, in a Midwestern state that shall remain anonymous until she tells about it later, if she does. And she had to be moved out of the state with police protection overnight because of threats to her life. Let's see here. Oh, and last but not least is our good friend Brandon Scott, who is an expert on everything, and self-proclaimed expert on everything. And actually, he's a good guy, and he's got an experience that he's going to share with us as well when the time comes. Okay, so that being said, okay, let's see here. So the format tonight will go as follows. Okay, I've got a few introductory remarks, and then Ken will talk. We would request tonight your cooperation that nobody ask any questions until he's done. We have this special nifty question jar, and we would submit for your request that you take a piece of paper and write your questions on here, okay? And we can pass these back, or you can come up. We'd like to coordinate it that way tonight. So write them down, put them in a special jar, and then we'll be able to facilitate those. The panel of experts will share some thoughts for 5 or 10 minutes or whatever each, and we'll also open it up for questions and answers, like I said, written down. So why do we hold these meetings, and specifically, why do we have this topic tonight? This is not a pleasant topic. This is not something that's going to make you happy. It's not going to be something that is, as ETB used to say, this is not going to tickle your ears. We would ask you, though, to have an open mind. I don't have an agenda here, to be honest with you. A lot of times I do, but tonight I don't. I served in southern Brazil, like Ken, about 30 years ago, and I had some experiences with Macumba, black magic, casting out evil spirits and things of that nature that I hadn't really even thought about much in the last 30 years. And if I let myself go there, it's a scary, dark place. But it was something we had to do, something we had to deal with, and especially in the fall time, like around Halloween night or All Saints night yesterday. But I would ask you to keep an open mind. Satan's greatest scam is, quote, there is no devil. There is no devil. And so by personal testimony, I can tell you that there is a devil, and he's real, and he's involved in Macumba, and he's involved in all kinds of other stuff that I don't even know about, and I don't really want to know the details about too much. But let me just tell you, so because someone asked me, well, why are you even doing this kind of a meeting? This is not something that's not a good thing we should be talking about. And I would just once again repeat a couple of verses that I find particularly important. Doctrine and Covenants, section 123, and it's also an imperative duty that we owe to all the rising generation and to all the pure in heart. For there are many yet on the earth among all the sects, parties, and dominations who are blinded by the subtle craftiness of men wherein they lie in wait to deceive, and who are only kept from the truth because they know not where to find it. Therefore, we should waste and wear out our lives in bringing to light all the hidden things of darkness wherein we know them, for they're truly manifest from heaven. So if you look back, if you look in the Bible, if you look in other scriptures, there's lots of warnings about the occult. There's lots of warnings about Satan. There's lots of warnings about this and that and the other thing. Funny thing is we believe in Scripture, but oftentimes we don't believe Scripture. And if the warning is, hey, you better be aware of this. I just read a verse. There's lots of other places. You ought to be aware of it. But if you just go through life with normalcy bias or cognitive dissonance where you just, someone mentioned something like this tonight, and I'm not accusing anybody here of that because you wouldn't be here if you thought that, I hope. But there are lots of our friends and neighbors that would just, turn out, hear no evil, see no evil, that kind of thing. And so I don't know if it's a denial thing or what exactly, but it's kind of like, before I go any further, I actually have a quick announcement that I forgot because I didn't see you. Dr. Ann Tracy is here. And she was going to take 60 seconds and tell us a little bit about the shooting today that some of you probably heard about. And also, she's going to be speaking here on the first Friday in April. Ann, you want to just take a second? And first Friday in April, which is, 5 months away. So we're getting booked way ahead of time now.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear it wasn't my car. I was kind of in a hurry. Anyway, I'm going to be speaking to the group in the next month, 2 months, 3 months. We're not sure yet. When you guys don't have super cold weather and lots of snow, I'll come up from southern warm Nevada. But I probably most of you know me. This is my antidepressant. No side effects. Anyway, I always remind people that God has given us all kinds of wonderful natural things to be able to deal with life. But, oh, her? Or me? I'm in a hole.
Is that better?
Okay. Anyway, so we wanted to give you just kind of a brief overview. I'm an expert on antidepressant adverse reactions. I was expert in Columbine, most of the school shootings, comedian Phil Hartman's murder-suicide, Andrea Yates' case, you name the case, I was probably there. Because antidepressants are involved in nearly every one of these shootings, like the one today. The young man, it has now come out, was suicidal. They were trying to find him. The family was worried sick. What people don't know is if you try to overdose on an antidepressant, you end up with the psychiatric side effects quicker than you die. So you do crazy, crazy things on your way out. But anyway, you can't increase serotonin the way these drugs do, and not have PCP and LSD-like effects over time. And that's what people don't know. 7 to 10% of the population do not have the liver function they need to break the drugs down, so they have toxic reactions. And one thing about tonight's meeting is one of the very first things I ever had reported to me is that if you wanted to be in an occult group, in a satanic group, the requirement for this guy's group was that you had to go on Prozac. Of course, that was early 90 when there was only the one of them out there. They all work the same way. So anyway, keep that in mind as you hear what you hear tonight. Thank you.
So we'll let you know the date on that, but I think it's going to be the first Friday of April, assuming that the snow has melted, she said. Okay. Okay, so back to where I was. How's that for a transition to come back? All right. James E. Faust said in 1987, October, the following, and he said the saint gave the same talk in 1994, so it must have been important he gave it twice. He says, quote, "For some reason I feel impressed today to speak against the devil and his angels, the source and mainspring of all evil. I do so prayerfully because Satan is not an enlightening subject. I consider him to be the great imitator. It is not good practice to become intrigued by Satan and his mysteries." And so you're probably saying, oh, wait a minute, what are we doing here tonight? Okay, we're not going to get intrigued by the mysteries and that kind of stuff. But he says, no good can come from getting close to evil. Like playing with fire is too easy to get burned. However, the knowledge of sin tempteth to its commission. However, he goes on to say, Brigham Young said that it is important to, quote, study evil and its consequences. That's what we're trying to do tonight. We're going to try to study evil objectively, kind of at arm's length or a little bit at length, to follow this counsel. Since Satan is the author of all evil in the world, it would therefore be essential to realize that he is the influence behind the opposition to the work of God. All right. Recently, I finished reading a book called The Franklin Cover-Up. Have any of you heard of it or read it? Have any of you read it? Okay, by John DeCamp. This is kind of what motivated me to try to do something with this tonight. And it talks about the book is documented. It was all court documents, basically, that is filled with. And this was back in 1992, and I went to the highest levels in the Justice Department, the FBI, and even the White House. That may be astonishing to some of you who are in here, because the U.S. government is good and holy and righteous and wholesome, right? We all know that, right? Did you get that? Did you get that innocent? But the reality is, I'm going to get there. I'm getting there. And it has to do with pedophilia, child porn, drug running, mind control programs from the CIA, child prostitution, child trafficking, child abuse and torture, and yes, satanic rituals. There's a lot of overlap in a lot of these things, as Dr. Ann just pointed out a minute ago. Not everybody that's a pedophile is necessarily a Satan worshiper. Not everybody that's a Satan worshiper is necessarily a pedophile, I suppose. But there is some overlap, it seems, and we're going to learn more about that from our experts later on. However, there were some cases or some accusations of some of this kind of stuff here in Utah back in the late 80s, early 90s. And on October 25th, 1991, the Deseret News released the following, quote, "Officials from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints said Friday they were evaluating reports that satanic cults dedicated to sexually abusing children are operating within the church. The issue arose Thursday with television reports about an internal church memo suggesting that as many as 800 people may be involved in the practice along the Wasatch Front. Quote, satanic worship and ritual abuse are problems that have been around for centuries and are international in scope, said a statement issued Friday by the church public affairs department. While they are numerically not a problem of major proportions among the Latter-day Saints, for those who may have been involved, they are serious. It goes on to say, the memo describing the satanic activities was written in July 1990 by Bishop Glenn L. Pace of the Presiding Bishopric. It was leaked to local media, including the Salt Lake Messenger, who actually broke the story, which is where I got the link, which is why it's an anti... Okay, so you got the background on that. So that was the first link. You can go down to the third one and maybe get it somewhere else. Okay, it's a 12-page document, addressed to the strengthening the church members committee. And in his memo, Bishop Pace said that satanic abusers in Utah represent a cross-section of the Mormon culture. The cult's members, he wrote, may include young women and young men leaders, bishops, a patriarch, a stake president, temple workers, and members of the Tabernacle Choir. Don't say the choir. Come on. I'm sorry. I should not joke about that. Okay, Tabernacle Choir. The abuses have even taken place in church meeting houses, he said, unquote. So that came out in 1991, and in conference of that same year, General Conference, Thomas S. Monson said the following on October 7th, quote, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints condemns in the harshest of terms physical, psychological, and sexual abuse, said Thomas Monson, Second Counselor and First Presidency. He went on to say, offenders should be brought to justice for their wicked and devilish conduct, liars, bullies who abuse children. They will one day reap the whirlwind of their foul deeds, he said. All right. So the document that it was talking about in question is this one right here, the Glenn Pace memo. I sent it to everybody that got the email, so you have that there, or you can go online and find it. It's not very hard to find. So then lastly, let me just read a sentence or two out of the Franklin cover-up that I thought was particularly significant. The use of mind-altering drugs, which was touched on, sensory deprivation and other brainwashing techniques on U.S. citizens as subjects was an admitted practice of the CIA. Certain military arms and private institutions that joined in the MK Ultra, Artichoke, and Bluebird projects beginning in the early 1950s. A national security pretext often cited was the need to keep up with the Soviets in the race to develop a workable Manchurian candidate human robot. With the Monarch, or whatever official title it may be attached to it, project, the idea is extended to the production of a horde of children in whom the soul is crushed, who would spy, whore, kill, and commit suicide. The material presented herein on this subject may be understood to be only a bare introduction to a complex story with immense political and strategic ramifications. It is a beginning. Professionals probing the child victims of Monarch say, there are clearly two responsible elements at work, the government/military and cooperating satanic, or to be more exact, pagan cults. These are multi-generational groups where parents donate their own children, who are proudly called bloodline or simply blood cultists, to be smashed with drugs and electric shock and shaped. Other children are kidnapped and sold into this hell or are brought in gradually through daycare situations. Surprised to hear this kind of harsh words, these hard things? If you are, then, you know, hopefully by the end of the night you won't be. But it's cognitive dissonance. We say, oh, that could never be. I don't know anybody like that. Well, let me tell you, a month ago, prior to me announcing this at Joel Skousen's event last month, I didn't know anybody. I've never met anybody that's been ritually abused, kidnapped, pedophiled, whored. I didn't know anybody. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means that I've for better or for worse, been sheltered from that. Hopefully the same is true with all of you, but I sense maybe it's not. Elements in the U.S., it's called cognitive dissonance, and we turn it off like it's too grand to be possible. And that's the same thing we do in politics, where most of us would have a hard time accepting the fact that the U.S. government funded, trained, created funds and trains Al-Qaeda. Okay? So go research that and give you something to think about for the weekend. Leviticus warned us about the burning fires of Moloch, children being burned in fires. It went on in the Middle East. It went on in Europe. It went on in Asia and in Mesoamerica. You can, for those of us that don't study history, history just repeats itself, and we don't know anything about it. So without any further ado, I would like to turn the time over to Ken for his presentation. Oh, and before for those of you who suspect that the Glenn Pace document memo might be fake, like somebody could have faked it to just embarrass the church, we have a special 30-second testimonial, or less than that maybe, Mr. Abe Day, a good friend of ours who actually spoke with Glenn Pace a number of years ago, and he can tell you what happened.
Yeah, I like to get primary sources for the information. I was passing this around to a friend of mine, and he expressed his doubt, and so I called up Glenn Pace, spoke with his secretary, asked her about it, and she had no idea. She looked into it. It actually freaked her out. Glenn Pace called me the next day. He was in a general authority at the time, and he says, "What are you bringing up 20 years ago?" You know, he's wondering why we were looking at this. And I says, "I just want to verify that this was true and that this is an actual real document. This is not forged." He says, "Yes, it's true. Nothing that is in that document didn't happen also in the Book of Mormon." He wanted to emphasize that. And so, you know, there's more details I could tell you, but just basically I did talk to him. This really is something that he did. And he also wants the message to know that hopefully we're studying the positive things too. So just want to let you know that that was an experience.
Okay, Ken.
Thank you very much. Good to see you, Sharon. I really appreciate this opportunity to be here with you tonight. For those who don't know me, let me just give you a real fast overview of my background. When I was about 14 years old, my parents joined the John Birch Society, and they held cottage meetings in our home. And they started saying some weird, crazy stuff. They started saying to me that there is a group of people, very, very rich, very powerful, behind the scenes, who control most of our organizations of power and influence in America. I'm going, yeah, right. I didn't believe it, you know. We elect our presidents, we elect our representatives and senators, and if we don't like what they do, then we kick them out, and somebody else will get in there who will. How short-sighted that was. I began studying the subject of secret combinations from that time on, and over the last 40-plus years, I must say, unfortunately, that they were right. And in my 40 years, I've come to the conclusion that there are three major branches or organizations of secret in this secret combination. The first branch is a political branch, is a financial branch, which includes the Federal Reserve. The second one is a political branch, which includes the Council on Foreign Relations. And the third one, I found out, is a religious branch. And the religious branch of this great secret combination is what we're going to study tonight. Satanic ritual abuse is part of it. The elite have a religion. And the name of their religion is Luciferianism. They believe in and worship Lucifer. I'll give you just a real small overview of their tenets. Luciferianism believes that there are two equal and opposing gods of equal strength that are fighting for humanity and fighting against humanity. The good god is Lucifer. And the evil god they term Adonai. And Adonai is a very old Hebrew name for the god that we worship. And that's what they believe. They really believe that. They also believe that Lucifer was the son of God and Christ is an imposter. Anyway, part of their religion requires human sacrifice. And they do it. Usually it's children, but it can be any human. You read about it in the scriptures, and when it says in the Old Testament that they made their children pass through the fire, that means they sacrificed their children in burnt offerings to their gods. And whenever any religion or anybody on the earth uses human sacrifice, you can put your bottom dollar down that that is of the devil. It is a devilish, satanic worship, no matter who it was, no matter what age of the world it was in. Satanic ritual abuse is part of this third branch of this great secret combination. Now, I've got some notes here. And one of the things it says is there will be a break after a while. Okay. I got to scratch that out. Okay. J. Edgar Hoover once said, "The average American is handicapped by coming up against a conspiracy so evil that he cannot conceive that it exists." And yet, that is true. We have to be able to stretch our minds and encompass this to understand it. It's very important. Now, we talked about the Pace memo. For those who haven't read it, you can just Google it, and there are a number of sites that have the Glenn L. Pace memo, and it's well worth reading. He makes mention that he interviewed 60 victims of it. And now I, myself, have studied and looked into this. I haven't looked into SRA specifically. But when I give my lectures on the third branch of this great secret combination, people come up to me who were victims or who were therapists or psychologists who have come across victims. As a matter of fact, and I won't mention any names here, while I was setting up, a lady came up to me tonight and mentioned that she was a victim, and she has a lot of knowledge about it, and I will be very interested in talking with her at a later date. So it happens. I have talked with therapists, and I have talked with victims. It is here, and it is more prevalent than I think we would like to know about. It's very uncomfortable for us. One of the great questions that we have to ask ourselves is, does it happen in the LDS Church? And the answer to that is yes, unequivocally yes. I wish it didn't, but there are people who are nominally members of the church who have not been discovered, who practice this evil monstrosity. And the next question I guess we should ask is, does anybody in leadership in the LDS Church practice it? And the answer to that is yes. Glenn L. Pace mentioned that he, when he talked with these victims, that they mentioned bishops, stake presidents, and other leaders in the LDS Church. And here's the $64,000 question. Do general authorities practice SRA? I don't know. But I'll give you an opinion. general authorities in the LDS Church are human. And they are susceptible to fall. They are susceptible to fall prey to false doctrines of any kind. They are susceptible to be able to turn against the LDS Church and become devilish in their minds and in their hearts themselves. As evidence of that, we know that Christ had his Judas. Joseph Smith had John C. Bennett, the William and Wilson Law, the Foster brothers, the Higbee brothers, and others who turned against him, who at one time thought he was a great prophet and then turned completely about him, turned completely about and sought his blood. So is it possible that there are members of the general authorities who practice it? It is possible. I don't think so. I don't know of any. But it is possible. But I tell you this, if there are some, and if there are anybody in this audience who came to participate in it, thinking that this might be something that was pro-SRA or something like that, if there's anybody in this audience like this, I would tell you, repent now. God has a special place in hell for people who abuse his children. You will weep and wail and gnash your teeth that you ever abused children in such a horrible way. So, I got off my soapbox. Now that we're talking about SRA in the LDS Church, I had the occasion, through Dr. Skousen, I came to know him in 2001, and for the next 4.5 years was by his side very constantly until he died in January of 2006. And he came to me one day and said, Ken, I want you to go on a secret mission for me. And I said, oh, yeah. Tell me what? Tell me where? And he said, there is an anti-Mormon organization that meets once a month in big buildings in Highland. Like, I'm sure it can't be him. Oh, no, not. No, it was something else. It was something else. But I gotta give a little dig at Tom here once in a while. And he said they meet in public places. They meet in Denny's restaurants once a month, and they talk about SRA going on in the Mormon Church. And he said, I want you to attend it and tell me what goes on in those meetings. He says, I would go myself, but they would recognize me, so I can't. So I did. The first month, I went there twice. I went to these meetings twice. First month I went, they talked about Wiccan. They talked about witchcraft. And New Age witchcraft, which is called Wiccan. And a lady got up there and talked about the chakras of the body and the third eye and the mantras and stuff. And I'm going there, oh, please, let me die. Somebody shoot me and put me out of my misery. Listening to New Age stuff is really weird. But it is part of this religion. It is part of it. The New Age was founded by a Luciferian by the name of Petrovna Blavatsky. She was a Russian who started the New Age movement, and she was backed and funded by Freemasonry. That's my investigation. That's what I found out. anyway, I went and listened to her, and she talked about all kinds of stuff, and I got bored with that. So I went back and reported to Dr. Skousen that nothing much happened there. They didn't talk much about the Mormon Church. So he said, okay, go back next month to another Denny's. And I went back the second time, and these meetings were held. I'm going to spill some beans here, and I'm going to name names, okay? This is something that has happened to me, and I've never talked about it to anybody before, and now you're the first ones to hear this. They were hosted by a man by the name of Doug Millar, M-I-L-L-A-R. Have any of you heard him? A few. A few of you have heard about him. He's an excommunicated, he's been excommunicated from the church, and he believes, he believes that the church believes, he believes that the church conducts SRA. Not isolated members of the church, but as a policy, the general authorities do it. At this second meeting I went to, his guest speaker was, you guys know this name, many of you know this name, his guest speaker was Dr. True Ott. How many of you know that name? More people. He has a radio station, I believe, doesn't he, up there in Salt Lake? And he talks about the New World Order. And when he talks about the New World Order, I've listened to him. He's pretty accurate. He seems to know what he's talking about. But he's an excommunicated member of the church, and he told his story, and this is his story. He said that he was a doctor of psychology, and he practiced down in Cedar City. And, you know, people would come into him with their regular problems. I got a paranoia here, and I've got a neurosis there, and people come in with their mental problems, and he helped them out, you know. He's just regular psychology. And then he started getting people, adults, who came in and said, I have these flashbacks of things that happened to me in my youth. I remember dark rooms and robes and candles and knives and blood. I remember children being sacrificed on altars. And at first, Dr. Ott said, oh, no, 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 this can't be happening. No, 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 this isn't true. This is, he had his cognitive dissidence, and he just couldn't believe something like that was happening. But more people came in, adults who had recollections of, scattered recollections of things that happened to them in their youth. And so many of them came forth that he started questioning them, questioning his beliefs. Maybe there is really something to this. Some of them started saying, my parents were involved in it, or my neighbor, or my uncle, or something like that. Some of them started saying, my bishop was involved. My stake president killed a child on an altar. And then some of them came forward and said, I remember Thomas Monson killing a child and drinking their blood. Others would come forward and say, yeah, to me it was President Hinckley or Boyd K. Packer or general authorities of the church were practicing this, and they were killing children and drinking their blood. At first, True Ott said to himself, this can't be true. He was a devout member of the church, returned missionary, and he believed in the church, and he was active in the church. This can't be true. But those people were absolutely adamant. I remember it was in my mind, fixed, and he could not dissuade them. After a while, so many people came into him with this problem that he started saying to himself, maybe it's true. And discreetly he went to his bishop and to his stake president and started telling him about this. Maybe they would lend a sympathetic ear, he thought. And they told him, this is not true, and if you keep on telling about these false accusations, if you keep talking about it, you could be tried for your membership. Be quiet about it. They told him to shut up. And that really threw him for a curve. He couldn't understand why they couldn't at least entertain the possibility, because all these people came forward and said, I remember I saw Thomas Monson. I saw Boyd K. Packer. I saw, you know, fill in the blank. They were absolutely convinced that it happened. So he started talking to people about this, and he got excommunicated from the church. And so he came to this second meeting that I attended and started telling about this. And he said, I really hate to say this, and he broke down and started crying. He started crying that he had to give up his membership in the church for the truth. Quote, unquote. And he said, I wish it weren't so with all my soul, but the evidence points in that direction. And then he told the audience, this was a big audience, it was about this size, maybe about this size. He told the audience, I have found out that there are there are 10 levels, 10 basements beneath the Salt Lake Temple. And at the bottom of the 10th basement, there is a room with an altar, and that is where the general authorities of the church take children and sacrifice them and drink their blood. That's what True Ott said. Now, any for any of you who know this guy, who've listened to him, if he talks about the New World Order, we don't take questions now. Come and write a question down here. He said, where was I? 10th floor. That's where they sacrifice children. And by golly, when he told me, when he said that to the audience, and I was down there writing, scribbling down notes, I wanted every word that he said, because I was going to go and blab. I was going to spill the beans about him, because I couldn't specifically refute those, but I knew in my heart that it was wrong. He was lying, and I had to find out the truth for myself, and I did. And I'll give it to you. But anyway, to continue the story, he made these allegations, and I wrote them down, and I went to W. Cleon Skousen, and he reported them to the general authorities. Now, what action they took, I have no idea, but that's the story. There are many other things he said, but that is what I remember. Now, here's the refutation of that. The first charge was that general authorities are participating in it, and these children have, at first, these memories came out in bits and pieces. But after a while, the full memories started to emerge, and they were absolutely convinced of it. Now, here's what happens. When these evil people conduct SRA on children, these children are pure and innocent, and they come from our Heavenly Father, and their minds are just pure, just beautiful. And what happens when something pure is debased with something totally evil, just incredibly evil? They can't handle it. They're just children. And these practitioners, these Satanists, these Luciferians, they have found out that when they come up against something so totally evil, the children will begin to dissociate in their minds, and they will split their personalities into different personalities so they can handle it. And I believe that this is what you found out too. There will be at least three personalities. The first personality will be the personality that the world sees. And, you know, you go, hey, Joe, how's it going? Oh, fine, Charlie. You know, the person that they display before the world. The second personality will be kind of like a Manchurian candidate kind of personality. They do this purposely so that they can give that personality a phrase or a tune or a word or a gesture that will trigger them into that personality. And in that personality, in this Manchurian candidate personality, they'll tell them to go do something and they'll do it. And then as soon as they've accomplished their mission, they will automatically snap out of it and they won't remember a thing. And it could include even a murder, you know, just like the Manchurian candidate movies that have come out. The third personality is the dark personality that has a vivid recall of everything that happened, and that personality is shoved back into the nether regions, and the person as they grow up try to never call on that personality. They try to forget that personality exists. But that's what they do, and that's why they do it, so that they can use these children to their evil advantages. So, here's what happens. These children, in such a delicate state, when they view these sacrifices, these human sacrifices, their minds are so shattered that they will accept any suggestion that's given to them. And these evil people will come to these children and they'll say, do you see that person up there who's sacrificing that little girl on the altar? He's cutting her open. You see him? That's Gordon B. Hinckley. Well, it isn't Gordon B. Hinckley. But they are so suggestible that they actually believe it. And they'll be given a picture of him. And they'll say, see? Here's a picture of Gordon B. Hinckley. That's him. And thereafter, that child will remember that name and associate that particular event with Gordon B. Hinckley, and they will have such a strong conviction of it, you can't tell them that it isn't. They do this for two reasons. Number one, they do that so they can cover themselves. Cover, CYA, cover your behind. That's what they do. And they also do it so that they can denigrate and possibly help destroy the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Because these children, they know that it's an imperfect art they have perfected, that sometimes these children will, in their adult lives, will start to remember these things. And when they do, they'll remember that it's Gordon B. Hinckley or Thomas S. Monson or Boyd K. Packer or somebody else that they've been told is doing this. And they'll believe it so strongly, they will fight to the last breath. I saw him. I know he did it. But it isn't true. And it takes a lot of recovery effort and kindness and love and the Spirit of the Holy Ghost to help these wounded people heal. And I hope that we will have the Spirit of the Holy Ghost here tonight, because what we're talking about is evil and it is ugly. But you know what? Even though the truth sometimes is ugly, the truth is always empowering. It empowers us. It gives us the knowledge to make correct decisions. And with correct knowledge, we can save ourselves from the evils that are in the world today. Okay. Now the refutation about the temple having 10 levels and they have a thing down there. I started reviewing that and researching that, And I came across a man who was a security guard, a former security guard at Salt Lake Temple. And he had a master key to every room, every room in the temple. And it was his assignment to change the air filters in every room in the temple, and that included the Holy of Holies and the apartment where the prophet stays once in a while, and all the ceiling rooms and all the other rooms and all of the basements and everything in the Salt Lake Temple. You know, they change them once a month so that you can have fresh air and you won't have germ and bacteria build up in the filters and so forth. He told me that there aren't 10 levels down there. There are four. And the fourth level, the bottommost level, is a family history room. And it's got microfiches and so forth and genealogical records. And he says this stuff about there being some kind of altar there is absolutely crazy. He had a master key to every room in the temple. So I know for a fact that Mr. Truott is a liar. And now he goes around spewing lies about the church, and I hope that you are able to understand and have the Spirit of the Holy Ghost and discernment with you to be able to discern these evil people. And I feel sorry for him because he got up there and started crying that he had to give up his membership in the church in order to pursue the truth. He was deceived. I feel sorry for him, and I hope that one day he'll come back, but that's his choice. Well, that's that story. I have another story, and I've thought very long and hard about talking about this, because it was a confidential paper that I read once from a general authority. I was invited into his office on Temple Square there, and he showed me this paper of a psychiatrist who had a patient under hypnosis. And they took this patient several levels down in the subconscious. And he found an evil spirit there. And this whole paper is a conversation between the psychiatrist and this evil spirit. He allowed me to read it and take notes on it. And I did that years ago. And these are my handwritten notes right here. I'm going to share some of the things that I discovered yet. I'm just going to read some of it off here. This is the first time I've ever shared this with anybody. And you're getting a first view of this. I don't have this in my books. I've never mentioned him in my lectures. He says, why do you do, the therapist says, why do you do what you do? And the spirit said, I have to. Therapist said, you have to? Why? Is somebody forcing you to continue this? Is there someone above you that forces you to do this? Who exercises compulsion on you? And the spirit said, you think too much in the other direction. If there was someone, he wouldn't be above me. He would be below me. Can we raise this? I want to do a little thing here on the blackboard. And then we'll put it back down. I'm going to tell you about the devil's doctrines. In Doctrine and Covenants, section 46, verse 7, it says, some doctrines are of men and others are of devils. And there's a way that you can tell if a certain doctrine, philosophy, idea, or something like that is either of men or of the devil. And it would be nice if I had something. I didn't even think about it. The doctrines of men tend to go off in tangents. So let's say that the gospel has a certain doctrine and it goes in this direction. The doctrines of men will go off like this, or they'll go down like this. But the doctrines of the devil, of Satan, are always, every single time, 180 degrees opposite of the truth. Hey, man, it didn't get better than this. John, you saved me. So here's the doctrine of Jesus Christ. Doctrines of men tend to go off, you know, on tangents, while the doctrines of the devil are always 180 degrees opposite. And that's how you can tell between ideas that come from men and ideas that have their origins in Satan. They're always, and you can take that to the bank, always 180 degrees opposite of the gospel. If the gospel says that Jesus is the Son of God and he's our Redeemer and Lucifer is the imposter, well, here is an actual doctrine of Luciferianism. They say that Lucifer is the Son of God, he's our Redeemer, and Jesus Christ is the imposter. And that's 180 degrees opposite of the truth. Everything about the devil is absolutely diametrically opposed. For instance, in the Lord's Church, we have this organization, an organization kind of like this, okay? Lay members here. And then they have local priesthood leaders here. Then you have state leaders there. We got a mouse in here or something. Then you have regional reps like that, and you have area reps, and you have the quorum of the general authorities, the 70s, the 12, and the first presidency up here. So I'm a lay member right here. That's me. That's not a caricature. That's really me. And I have over me people who have priesthood authority, and over them and over them and over them to the prophet and so forth to our Savior. The devil is exactly the opposite. Here are the lay members of the devil's organization. Here's a devil right here. Kind of looks like me. Ew. Scary thought. And then there are those who control him and exercise authority under him, not over him, under him. And there are those who are layered under them and under them and under them until you come down here to Satan. And he's under them all, which means he has control of them all. It's exactly the opposite. So I just thought I'd throw that in there. Excuse me, I just got to take a drink here.
So how are you doing so far? Anybody want to get up and walk out yet? I do.
Sometimes we can't get what we want. Okay, now the rest of the time I want to talk about some of the organizations that are representative in this third branch of this secret combination, this religious branch. I'm going to touch on witchcraft, Satanism, Luciferianism, and I'm especially going to dwell on Freemasonry. I hope there are no Freemasons in this, because what I have to say about Freemasonry is not flattering exactly, but it is the truth. And I wish I could say that Freemasonry is 100% a fraternal organization dedicated to the betterment of mankind, and that's what they do. Well, the truth is that 99.9% of the Freemasons are in that category, and they do good, and they're good people, and they do good works. And it's absolutely true. There's no question about it. But they are not the ones in control. They are not the ones who are the leaders of Freemasonry. It has been I have found out through my own investigations that at the very top in Freemasonry, they are Luciferians, as are Satanists and also are witchcraft. And I found out something extra that really blew my mind. In the initiatory rites of Freemasonry, they are the same as the initiatory rites of witchcraft. Word for word, action for action. They come from the same source. Joseph Smith, when he was a Freemason, yes, in Illinois in the 1840s, he said about Freemasonry, he said, it is an apostate form of the true temple worship. Now, people have come to me, good Freemasons and others who look kindly on Freemasonry, and they say, you know, how can Freemasonry be involved in Luciferianism or devil worship when George Washington and many of our founding fathers, when Joseph Smith and many of our founding fathers of the Mormon Church were Freemasons? This is a good question. And there's an answer to that. And I had to dig to find that out because it bothered me. How could such a man who was inspired of God like Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, as a matter of fact, the first five presidents of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints were Masons. And they joined, all of them joined in the 1840 era of Nauvoo during that time. Many of the apostles, many of our founding fathers who are very spiritual men were Freemasons. So how could it possibly be that they are Luciferians? I'm going to give you a little history of Freemasonry so that we can find out the truth about this, because it's necessary to know this. Freemasonry came into existence under that name in 1717 in London. The first Freemason lodge was opened in London. And at first it was what it's purported to be. It was a fraternal organization dedicated to the betterment of mankind. In 1776, there was an offshoot of Freemasonry called the Order of the Illuminati. They were founded in Bavaria, Germany, May 1st, 1776. They were occultists. Adam Weishaupt, the founder, was a Luciferian. In the practice of the Illuminati, they had a rite called the Palladian Rite, which introduced members of the Illuminati into the worship of Lucifer. This is in 1776. In 1782, from the beginning, they looked at Freemasonry and thought, hey, man, this is a secret organization. We can take them over. And they tried everything they could to do that. And from 1782 to 1784, they accomplished their goal. And they introduced the Palladian Rite into Freemasonry only at the top levels. And I'll explain that a little more in detail a little further on. In those days, there were two centers of Freemasonry. They were not joined in one worldwide bond or constitution or anything. There was European Freemasonry and there was American Freemasonry. And in the writings of George Washington, he says, I realized that the Illuminati have had influence in European Freemasonry. Nobody knows more about. Nobody is more assured of that than I am. Those are in the writings of George Washington. You can look that up on the internet. But in American Freemasonry, they had their own head. The American Freemasonry, European Freemasonry had all the same rights, all the same tokens, all the same penalties, all the same oaths and covenants. But they were under a different head. Under American Freemasonry, they did not have the worship of Lucifer. So it was very possible for inspired men like George Washington and Brigham Young and Joseph Smith and others to partake in American Freemasonry and not detect the devil in that organization. It wasn't until 1870 that the head of Freemasonry in Europe, an Italian by the name of Giuseppe Mazzini, got in contact with the American head, Grand Master of Freemasonry, Albert Pike. Albert Pike was a disgruntled ex-Confederate general. In 1870, that's 5 years after the close of the Civil War, and he was persuaded by Giuseppe Mazzini to incorporate both American and European Freemasonry under one head. They drew up a constitution, and they introduced the Palladian Rite to American Freemasonry in 1870. So up until then, good people could belong to that organization and not be able to detect anything. They weren't officially worshiping Lucifer. But it wasn't until 1870 that happened. Today, there are three centers in the world that practice the Palladian Rite in Freemasonry. That's the Grand Lodges of Berlin, Rome, and Washington, D.C. It is quite, you could go to the head of the Freemason Lodge here and ask them if they worship Lucifer or if they know anything about a Palladian rite, and they'll laugh at you because they don't. They don't practice it. They don't have any knowledge of it. What happens is that the 33rd degree is divided into two. Now, whether it's a numerical division that 50% is in one part and 50% is in another part, or whether it's 80 in one part and 20% in another part, I don't know. I think it's more like 90 and 10. But there is a small group that are introduced into the worship of Lucifer. And they are the ones that lead Freemasonry. They are the ones that set the agenda. I'm having a problem with English. I've only practiced it all my life, so I'm at a disadvantage. Anyway, they set the agenda. They control. And they hide behind the good works of the vast majority of Freemasons to make you think that it's an innocent fraternal organization. Because of those who are in control of it, it is not innocent. It is an evil organization. If there's any Freemasons in here, and I don't want to step on any toes, but I've been asked to give my conclusions at this meeting tonight. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But I would ask you to ask the Spirit of the Holy Ghost within you whether I'm saying what I'm saying is true. And if you're a member of Freemasonry, I would advise you get out of their employ. Get out of it. Now, what is the evil that Freemasonry does? They like to influence politics. And sometimes they will be in positions of power, but usually they will be like chief advisors to those who are in position. They'll be the power behind the throne, the influencers, the advisors. And I know this for true. I know this is true personally. Because soon after my book, Hiding in Plain Sight, I come up and get one, you know, make me rich, buy 1,000, okay? Soon after my book came out, I decided to give a copy to Orrin Hatch, our senator. I hoped maybe to influence him for good, you know? So I went down to the federal building about 150 South State, coincidentally right across the street from the Federal Reserve of Salt Lake. And I went down there to give him a copy of my book, Hiding in Plain Sight. Well, he wasn't there that day, but his chief advisor was. Anybody hear of Rod Madsen? He used to be chief advisor to Orrin Hatch. I think he's been fired. I don't think he's with him anymore. But for years, he was his chief advisor. And I gave him my book, and I said, would you give this to Orrin Hatch, Hiding in Plain Sight? And he said, okay, what's it about? And I says, well, it talks about the secret conspiracies that own the world today. And he says, does it mention Freemasons? I didn't know what I was getting into. I said, yes, well, they're part of it. And he says, well, that's absolutely false. I'm a Freemason, a 32nd degree Freemason, and I know absolutely that they are good people and they don't have any aspirations on the world or anything like that. So, I found a witness right there that they do try to influence politics. They do work towards a new world order. They do try to influence their political friends, the people who are in power, to go along and try to increase the size of government and to join with other nations into an international one-world government called the New World Order. It's true. I'm absolutely convinced of it. So that is kind of where that stands. Now, how does one get to be in that situation? I had to dig for this, but I found out. I read the story of a man who was a 33rd degree Mason. And his story was very interesting. He said that he and another man went down to the Grand Lodge in Washington, D.C. to be interviewed to be a Freemason. He went in first. And he was interviewing there, and they asked him questions. And one question they asked him is, are you a Christian? And he said, yes, I am. And that puzzled him because up until that time, they had never asked questions about Christians in Freemasonry. They admit anybody, Jews, agnostics, atheists, Christians, anybody. And they don't care what your religion is, but they asked him specifically, was he a Christian? He said, yes. And then they asked him, if somebody gave you a cross and told you to spit on it, would you do that? And he said, absolutely not. I worship Jesus. I would never spit on his cross. And they said, that's the correct answer. Go out this way, please. Then he went out and sat in the hall, and the guy he was with went in for his interview. And when the other guy came out, he said, did they ask you whether you were a Christian? And he said, yes. And he said, what did you answer? And he said, hell no, I'm no Christian. I'm an agnostic. I don't believe in Christianity. I don't mean this mumbo jumbo about Jesus. And they said to him, and then the first man said, when they asked you about the cross and spitting on the cross, what did you say? And he said, yeah, hell yes. Why not? I don't care about Christ. I'd spit on the cross anytime. And this was their answer. You are going up further. Those things, those questions are a test to see if you are a devout Christian. If you are, you fail the test. You'll be given your 33rd degree, and you'll be a regular member of society, and you'll be a good, productive member. And these people are good, honest people. They're next-door neighbors, and they're lovable people. It is those people who despise Christianity who are allowed to advance in Freemasonry. That took me a lot of investigation to find out. Like I said, the 33rd degree is divided into, and I don't know exactly what it is, whether it's 80-20 or 90-10, 90% are Christians and 10%. But whoever, whatever the division is, those who are anti-Christian and who have a smoldering hatred of Christianity are the governing powers of Freemasonry. Now, I had a problem with this. A lady wrote me an email a few days ago, explained to me how good Freemasons are. And she's right. Freemasons are good, moral people. But they are duped. They do not understand the organization they work with, the real nature of it. And if I've stepped on some toes here, I honestly, please, I ask your, beg your forgiveness. But this is what I've found out, and I hope, I just hope that the Spirit can touch your hearts about this. There is one final thing that I want to talk about tonight. History is often so full of conundrums, things that are so hard to explain. We are told in history that America went through a terrible, terrible crisis in the 1690s. Because evil Christians were putting to death, accusing the innocent people of being witches. And they were executing them. And you know, that blew my mind. I read in the Book of Mormon that the founding fathers, the Puritans that came over here, as is explained in 1 Nephi chapter 13, they humbled themselves before God, and the Spirit of God was with them. And they were able to become free people. And I said, that's not congruent with the idea that good Christians are persecuting poor people and accusing them of being witches and executing them. I don't understand that. So I studied it, and I researched it. And it took me years to find out this answer. The truth is exactly the opposite of what we are told in the history books. We're told that Christians accused people of being witches and executed them. The truth is exactly the opposite. Witches were accusing Christians of being witches and having them executed so that they could gain their property. Can you believe this? This is history you've never heard. And I've had it verified to me by other sources. What happened was, during those days, when the pilgrims came over on the Mayflower, there was one family the Todd family, who were witches. They were part of witchcraft. The rest were good practicing Christians. The Todd family was not allowed to live among them, so they went out and made their own. They made their own way. And as different ships came over from England, more witches came. Witchcraft was established early in America. They were rather indolent people, while the Christians were rather productive, and they accumulated wealth. And the witches started to envy those who had the wealth, the Christians. They devised a way to cheat them out of their property. They started participating in local elections as if they were good, honest Christians, and they came into positions of power in their judicial system back then, and in their sheriffs or constables and so forth. And what they did was they put up their daughters. Did you know that the accusers in the Salem witch trials were all of them young women of adolescent or teenage years? There's about 15 of them, I think, or 20 of them, I don't know. And they were children of witches. And they were told, when we bring someone before you, you accuse them of being witches. And these children, and this is in the historical records, when let's say, Anne Hutchinson. You see, there were 20 people who were executed as witches. 18 of them were women. There were two men. When they brought in a woman, let's say her name was Anne Hutchins, they on cue would say, "Witch, witch, witch," these accusers, these 15 young women. They would fall on the ground. They would bark like dogs. They would jump on the desks. They would paw at the air. They would howl at the moon. And they would accuse these women of having put devils inside them and made them give them curses so that they were possessed. And all the while, they were children of witches. And when the good people of Salem found that out, saw that, they were deceived. They thought that these terrible people, they taught these children to telling the truth, and these women were witches. So they executed them. And just about every one of the women were like widows who had possessions, property, or they were children whose parents had died and they were unmarried. They had possessions and property. And when they were executed, then their property came up at public auction. And because those who were in authority were witches, they made sure that the witches put up the bids that got the property. This kind of human history is really weird. I know. And if you don't believe it, I don't even blame you. But I investigated it, and I found that that's the truth. Witches accused Christians of being witches and had them executed so that they could confiscate their property. This is all part of this third arm of this great secret combination. Now, I'm going to let it rest there. There's a lot more information that I could give you, and I wish you could, but we just don't have the time. He wrote this book called Morals and Dogma, and it is given to everyone who graduates from the 32nd degree as kind of a guiding light. It's been called the Freemason's Bible. And no, it is not their Bible, but it is a very important book in their fraternity. Sure, you can get this from Amazon. And Yeah, you can. I'm sure you can find it on the internet. Morals and Dogma by Albert Pike. Let me just read you some of the things that they say right out of this Freemason book. Let me. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Et cetera, et cetera. I'm fill the time until I get what I want. Okay. Listen to this statement in Morals and Dogma. Lucifer, the light bearer. Strange and mysterious name to give to the spirit of darkness. Lucifer, the son of the morning. Is it he who bears the light? And with its splendors intolerable, blinds, feeble, sensual, or selfish souls? Doubt it not. Now, I don't know about you, but that seems to be praising Lucifer. 321. Page 321. Here, bear witness. Is that what it says? Let's look on page 566. And if it isn't there, it'll be somewhere else. Okay. I have to introduce this last quote right here. In order to understand this, what I'm about to tell you, you have to understand what I told you earlier, that with evil, with Satan, everything is opposite of what it should be, of what we believe. We believe yes, they believe no. We believe in light, they believe in darkness. Here, so understanding that, maybe you can understand what I'm going to read you here. It says, the prince of darkness, now this is devil language, the prince of darkness with their consent, made Adam. Who made Adam? The prince of darkness? No, God made Adam. But this says the prince of darkness made Adam, whose soul was of the divine light, contributed by the eons and his body of matter, so that he belonged to both empires, that of light and that of darkness. To prevent the light from escaping at once, the demons, this is what it says, the demons forbade Adam to eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. The demons forbade him to eat. Now, who told Adam to not eat of the fruit of the tree? God told Adam. And to them, it was the demons, by which he would know the empire of light and that of darkness. He obeyed. An angel of light induced him to transgress. Who is that? Satan. An angel of light induced him to transgress and gave him the means of victory, but the demons created Eve, who seduced him into an act of sensualism that enfeebled him and bound him anew in the bonds of matter. I read this stuff and I want to go, bleh. Oh, geez. Later down on the page here, it says, Satan is the son and lord of matter, and the secondary angels and demons are children of matter. Satan created and governs the visible world. Now, to those who believe in Freemasonry, that it is it's just a regular fraternal organization, what are people like me who are on the outside looking in, what are we supposed to believe when we read things like this and when we see videos like this? Are we supposed to believe that they truly are dedicated to Christianity and believe in Christ? The evidence points in the opposite direction. So, again, I reiterate, if there are good people here who really believe in Freemasonry, I would say get out of it. It's up to you. You can make your own decisions. I would beg you to get out of it. So that is my presentation. And if anybody wants to buy a book, they're right up here. And if you want me to come by and give you lectures, I have 20 lectures that I give. And I can come to your homes. I can come to your organizations if you have a garden club or, you know, a book club or something like that. Let me come and give you lectures, and we can arrange for that. Thank you for letting me come, and I think you guys are very good. Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and start with our panel of experts here. They're going to talk a few minutes each, introduce themselves. We've got some mics here. And then, once again, if you have questions, please come up and take a piece of paper and throw it in the jar, and then we'll be able to start on that in a few minutes here. So the first person here is Sharon Reese.
I'm going to stand up just so that I can stay awake. Not that you put me asleep. It's my bedtime. No. I'm from Colorado, one of seven children. I was richly abused from age 3 to age 9. Didn't get my memories until I was like 45 or 46. In 1992, I started getting ritual abuse memories, and they came all in one night. And I was awake all night dealing with, when I closed my eyes, all of these hideous memories came into my mind. So I opened my eyes because I didn't want to see this stuff. And but it happened all night. I'd get up and go eat something. I'd turn a light on, and when I closed my eyes, the memories would come back. So I was all night dealing with just horrendous abuse that was happening to children, with men in black robes around fires, coffins, and all sorts of abuse to children. And anyway, I went to sleep at 6 o'clock in the morning, and at 7 o'clock I woke up to the door closing. My husband had left for work. I sat up on the sofa because I spent the night there, so I wouldn't keep him awake from the memories. And my sofa started to shake, and the pictures on my wall started to shake, and we had an earthquake. So it was a perfect ending to a most horrendous night. But so I began therapy. That was in March of 92. That really sent me running to therapy. It was a very frightening night. And I was in the office of Noemi Mattis, who is, I would say, probably an expert ritual abuse therapist. And I began pacing the floor back and forth, and she said, "So who's this pacing?" And I said, "Me, of course." And she said, "No, who's pacing?" And I said, "Me." And she really irritated me, but she said, "No. You know," she said, "Sharon, you can admit that you have multiple personalities and begin your healing, and I can help you to heal, or you can deny it and postpone it. It's your choice. But if you'll stick with me, I'll help you to heal." So I was a believer then, and I felt like I had been caught and spotted, and I had to face the fact that she was correct. And only four of my friends had suggested that something awful had happened to me and that I had many personalities, because they saw it. They walked with me. They hiked with me. They saw that one day I believed this and the next day I believed that, and they just saw different parts of me, and I didn't see it because I wasn't walking beside me. But so I started dealing with memories for the next 7 or 8 years. They came back, all those memories came back one at a time. They came back at times when I finally felt safe. My children were all in school, and I had the time to put into the emotional healing from this real atrocity. There really is a God. There really is a Satan. But you know, in the end, God really does win. But I was really programmed against God. And I was programmed in a lot of ways. And mind control was used on me, and torture was used. And brainwashing was used. lot of programming was done so that I never thought out of my mind. I thought out of their mind always. All my answers always were whatever I was programmed to answer. I didn't know who I was. I really didn't even have a me. And I apologize. I've told this story before. I used a lot of tools to heal. I had expert therapists. I was able to have therapy, had the money for therapy. I used music and art and writing and hiking the mountains and every good, wholesome, free thing to help me to heal. It took 8 years. Weekly therapy, it took my life away from me. It took my life away from my children and my husband. I didn't develop through the ages, the developmental stages of a child. So when I began to heal, I had to heal the 3-year-old, the 4-year-old, all the way up to, I didn't even get to be a teenager. I didn't get to rebel like teenagers do, because I was terrified if I didn't obey everything I was told to do. The Book of Mormon states clearly the sacrifices that are done. I mean, it's real, and our communities need advocates that believe this. And that will look for symptoms, and that will look for people that say weird things, that look funny, that get afraid of everything, because they're out there. And if you'll notice, you'll see them. You'll see them in church. You'll see them in the grocery stores. You'll see it in the children. And if you want to go online, there's all the signs and symptoms of abuse. But I just want you to know it's real. And I would love, at the very end of this meeting, if I have permission, I will stop now. Say a lot, but it happened to me, and it messed up my life, but I have my life back. I've lived sane for 11 years. I live a normal life. I garden. I have friends. I love my family and my kids, but this stuff is real, and it's evil, and it's happening probably as we speak, as I speak tonight. But really, the last thing I'd like to close with, if I can, I don't know if it'll work, but I brought a song that I wrote years ago when I was wondering why I don't have peace in my life. And I saw wars raging everywhere. And there was one raging in me. And so I wrote about it. Because internally I wasn't at peace, but I didn't know why, because I was dissociative. And I had post-traumatic stress and many personalities and DID. But I wrote this song called A War is Raging. I'd like to end on that if we could. I think it'd be a good ending. And what I would do is I just play that and put the microphone and maybe it'll work. But anyway, that's my story. I wrote a book about healing from this, and I'm writing my life story now, and I wrote a CD that kind of has just promoted healing as part of my healing, and I feel pretty sane. I have emotions. I'm not frozen. That's great. I know how to cry. Thank you.
I'm Judy Moore. I'm a family practice physician, and you wouldn't think that I would be in the arena of healing and working with people from SRA, satanic ritual abuse. But the first year I was in practice, I'm an osteopathic physician, and I was doing some manipulation on a woman, and she went into what they call an obreaction. And that is, it's part of PTSD where they start reliving the memory as if they are that child being abused. I had never heard of it. I didn't know what was happening. I just prayed and did the best I could to assist her through it. And then she asked me at that time if I knew what, once she worked through it, if I knew what multiple personality disorder was. And at that time, now it's called dissociative identity disorder, but at that time it was multiple personality, and she said she had it because she had suffered from satanic ritual abuse. She had lived with her grandparents, and they were pastors of a Pentecostal church, And it seems like the Lord has led me people into my office, and I don't claim to be an expert, but I tend to get people that have had these experiences, and they've been from every religion. I had one who was a Catholic and dealt with a lot of the Catholic rituals in Satanism, and I've had people who were other religions, and I've had people who were of the Mormon religion, and their Satanism was geared around, you know, temple ceremonies and baptism and various and sundry things. These kids are deliberately dissociated. They give them drugs and torture to get their minds to split. And if they cannot split, then either they are sacrificed or discarded if they feel like they're young enough that there will be no memory. It really is a scary and horrible thing. And I have heard stories similar to the patients of True Hope. The truth will learn someday. I have prayed and prayed and have not received an answer. I still go to church. I still believe in the church. I feel like God is leading us, but I don't know the answer about the darkness and who is participating in it. I'm sure there are people in the audience who have been, are survivors of ritual abuse. There may possibly be people in the audience who have been involved in perpetrating ritual abuse. It is much more common than we believe. I can't believe that I would just get the rare person, the very rare person that had it, that ends up in my office. I think it's much more common than we believe. It is important now to speak, and I honor the people on this panel and other people who have the courage to stand up and speak. The people who are tortured and who are survivors have been programmed to be quiet, and if they get the urge to speak, often they're programmed to commit suicide, or their families are threatened, or their life is threatened. And so to speak up is going against all the programming that was given to them. And it's extremely hard and frightening for them. So I really appreciate that there are more and more survivors today that are willing to stand up and speak about what happened to them. Thank you.
I'm Christy Greenouch, and I'm a survivor. I had the opportunity to, I grew up in Pleasant Grove. We had our own little order, is what they called it. By the time I was very young, infancy, up into, I thought, until five, because my perpetrator was my mother's best friend's husband, so our families were very, very close. And we left for Samoa when I was 5 years old, and they rented our home. And then just this last year, I had another memory show up, and I was age 9. So I don't know if I'm through with all my memory parts that have to come forward, but I do know that some of the experiences that I have been shown and had come, mine came in my 30s as my memories began to come forth. Having my children and experiences with them brought triggers and things. Going to the temple brought triggers. Water was very frightening for me. One of my first memories was being held by my ankles down into a barrel of water until I was to be drowned. And when they pulled me out, because I was ready to just give up, they said, "See, Jesus didn't save you, we did." So on the line of what he was saying, the gentleman in our order was very strong within the church and our community. People looked up to him very much as this very strong priesthood leader. He tried to have my parents excommunicated about 5 times. It didn't work. Now I kind of look back at that and understand why he was trying to expose our family for some reason to break us. My parents had no idea what was happening. Even when my memories came and my two sisters' memories also came, my mother could not believe that was could happen, you know, right here in our own neighborhood and near our home and to people that she knew, until the siblings of our perpetrator came forward also and shared with her some of their memories. And I got to be able to talk with my friend, who was more closest to my age last year. And she can't even remember growing up with me and the things we did as a family. That's how blocked everything had happened for her. She remembered me in high school. And so we visited with things that she shared with me, especially it happened in my home while I was gone. And I remember as a young girl coming back home and seeing evil spirits in and out of my basement all the time. Didn't dare say anything to my parents, thought I was making it up. But now I understand that some of those things were happening in my home, and my father didn't think to clear the house again because this was a priesthood family that lived in our home. But she let me know that her father did get excommunicated, but not because of that. Ritual didn't come up at all. But he did get excommunicated, and she was told that he was demoted in his order when he got excommunicated, and that for him to be high up in his order, he needed to be a member of the church. So he worked hard, and he tried three times to get back in. The girls fought it. They have a division. The boys don't believe anything happened, but sad to say, the boys were part of it, and their memories have not come forward. And my heart goes out to them the day that their memories come forth, that they were part of what took place. But right now they're in that denial situation, but he just got in his 70s. He just got back in the church. And I don't know if that order's still going on or whatever, but he fought hard to get back in. But anyway, one of my memories that I had, because sometimes you might want to ask the question, why would a loving Heavenly Father allow us as children or any of us to go through such horrific things? Why? I asked that question when I had a memory and I was 2 years old. I won't share with you the horrific thing that was being done to my body, but my spirit, thank goodness, mercy is there that our spirit can check out, if you will, so we don't have to be present with the experience. But the Savior was holding me, and at first I was mad at him. I said, why? Why didn't you stop this? Why did you let this keep going on? And with tears in his eyes, he said, because of agency that is given to man, but I never left you alone. I had to hang on to that when other memories would come up, knowing that agency is huge. It's what we had before we came here. It's what we have in all of our choices of life. And I had a week's worth of heavy-duty deprogramming, if you will, and learn some interesting things. And as things would show up and memories show up, at the end of that week, I realized something. They might have had power to hurt my body, but they didn't take my soul. That me, as a daughter of God, is stronger. Each of us is stronger than all the darkness in this world. And it is here, and it's increasing, because old Spoiler knows his time is coming to an end. And not only does he have his forces out full-fledged, so do Heavenly Father and his angels. Know that we are not alone. We do not need to fear the darkness, for they want our souls, yes, but we have the body that they longed for and still long for. We are more powerful because we have this body. Remember that. Do not fear, for that is what they play on. And that is why they go for the children, because they play upon the fear And the scare tactics and the mind control and all those things that do work and they do affect your lives. It does feel like it ruins your life, ruins relationships. And I want to say the Lord bless the husbands or the wives that are the spouse that hangs on through the memories. They deserve gold medals because it's not an easy thing, because you are rejected by your spouse. You don't want anything to do with them when those memories come up, or you get angry, you get frightened, and they don't understand, but they're right there. My husband, I know Sharon's husband's been right there with us through it, and I'm so, so grateful. Don't lose faith. Don't lose faith. We all are human. We all do make mistakes, but never lose faith in the Lord and our God, Jesus Christ. Christy Greenouch. Christy Greenouch.
And I am Judy Byington. That's my maiden name. I'm married to this wonderful person in the back. I'm a retired therapist. I worked for 23 years in therapy, and I was a former mental health supervisor. And during that time, I became acquainted with people who I eventually found were ritually abused, but at the time I didn't recognize it. But they would come into the office and say things like, I can't remember my childhood, or I hear voices in my head. And it's not just you can't remember your childhood, it's just a complete blank. And there are complete blanks in your life. And then I went through a very humbling experience in my life where I had a very sick daughter. I wasn't able to work. I was under a divorce, and I had 5 teenagers and a boy on a mission. And I had absolutely no income whatsoever coming into the home. And it really brought me to my knees. And during that time, a woman came to me who was the former husband, former wife of a satanic coven leader here in Utah County. And he had just been arrested by the Utah Attorney General's Office of Special Investigations. For they had just hired ritual abuse investigators at the Utah AG office, and her oldest daughter, who was married, and the cousin of the oldest daughter, who was also married, they were the very same age. They had had an accidental meeting down at the University Mall, and they had found out that they were starting to have their memories come back of their ritual abuse during childhood. And this woman said, the Utah AG office won't listen to us because they're multiple personalities, but they're getting all these memories of these child killings and being raped during childhood. Satanic ritual abuse always involves sexual abuse. It always involves child murders. It always involves the torture of children, because they do that purposely to divide the mind. And so they were having all these memories, and she asked me to help them. And I went to Heavenly Father, and I said, I can't do this. And he told me, yes, you can. And that began my life's journey. And I'll go through it very briefly, but we weren't able to have the man convicted. He got off on a quirk of the law. But I did meet, during that time, a lot of other ritual abuse survivors, and I am just absolutely appalled at how evasive, it's all over. Because they knew I was working with it, they would come up to me, but I could count 20 within a few blocks of my home of ritual abuse survivors. And I began working with the state ritual abuse investigators, and they told me that there were 8 covens in Utah, and they were, you know, trying to investigate them. So I eventually ran into, not ran into, I took some of the information to the FBI, and the very same day I took the information to the FBI, a woman approached me by the name of Jenny Hill. Well, Jenny Hill had also contacted this very same FBI agent, and she was looking for the parents of a child she saw murdered. She had been ritually abused down in Garden Grove, California. She now lives here in Utah County. And I ended up writing her biography, and it's 22 faces, inside the extraordinary life of Jenny Hill and her 22 multiple personalities. And when this book came out about a year and a half ago, literally all hell broke loose. We had people from both sides really come after the book. And I found out one of the reasons for that was because Jenny's master mind control programmer was a man by the name of Dr. Greenbaum. Now, how that whole history is that back in 1950, the CIA brought into the United States Nazi specialists from Nazi Germany. A lot of those specialists were for their mind control program. So their mind control program began in around 1950. And it's very interesting that in the 1980s you have what they called the Satanism scare. That's about 30 years or so after these programmers came into the U.S. Now, what we're talking about with mind control, we're talking about disassociation, as they pointed out. Everybody dissociates. You know, it goes from daydreaming to post-traumatic stress to multiple personality disorder, kind of on the spectrum. But with a child in the developing brain, if they undergo a lot of trauma, they go into multiple personalities. It's a very deliberate programming. Think of your mind as a tree, and the trunk of the tree is your core personality. And if you're a child going through trauma, that traumatic experience will go out as a branch of the tree, and it'll be held by an alter personality out there on that branch until 20, 30, sometimes 40 years later, until the mind is able, you know, to handle the situation. That is the purpose of mind control, is to control the individual and to break them into different personalities. And in Jenny's biography, there's an alter chart, and there's very specific alters that they break out, and then they call them specific names, specific Latin names, and then anybody knows that if that person has been mind controlled, that they can call that alter out by that specific name, and therefore the alter will take over the body, and that's how they control. That's one of the ways that they control a person. So now we have, in 1980s, we have all these people coming out saying, we have been, you know, ritually abused. And one of the reasons they came out is a book came out by the name Michelle Remembers. And Michelle Remembers is a little girl, well, she was a little girl up in Canada, who was given by her mother to a satanic cult. And she eventually had her memories come back, and her and her psychiatrist husband wrote the book, Michelle Remembers. Well, when Michelle Remembers came out, there were literally thousands of ritual abuse survivors who started going to therapists. Some of those were LDS, and they started to go to LDS social services. President Benson was president of the church at the time. He became aware of it. He asked Elder Pace to do the LDS report. It was a 12-member committee. They worked for a whole year gathering information, and then Elder Pace wrote up this report. After the report was written up, the church excommunicated all the perpetrators. They actually hired a genealogist in California to trace the families. This all comes down in lines, multi-generational lines, satanic families, and they traced the perpetrators, they excommunicated the ones they found, then they turned over the information to the Utah AG office. At the same time, Sharon's therapist, Noemi Mattis, was co-chair of a legislative committee who was also doing a study on therapists and investigators in the state. They found some of the same information as in the LDS report, and that's when they got the money to hire these special investigators. I was able to interview with the investigators, and I have been working with the AG office on different satanic information since, and especially with special investigations at the Utah AG office. So we have that happening in 1990. And then prior to that, the CIA, in about 1964 or so, the CIA supposedly ended their program because they were sued by one of the survivors, a group of survivors, and they supposedly ended their program in 1964. But now we have still a lot of people coming forward saying we were ritually abused, and a lot of them weren't even born until after 1964. Jenny's particular experience took place in 1965 after the documents were destroyed in 1973. Then we have a couple of committees formed by the congressional Congress forms these committees, and they interview survivors, and they give us all this information, and then Congress literally doesn't release the information, and they don't do one thing about it. And that's why we believe it's still continuing today, because we have all these survivors coming forth. When this book came out, I became acquainted with some very large organizations of ritual abuse survivors. One is in Connecticut. It's called SMART. One is in Seattle, Washington. It's called Ivory Garden. And they represent over 5,000 ritual abuse survivors. The gal that runs Ivory Garden says there's as many as 300 active on her website every day. We have a very, very big problem. If you go into our website, it's called Child Abuse Recovery, CAR. There is a petition on the website. It's very interesting to read, and I'd like you to sign it if you're so inclined. We're trying to get a congressional investigation of the CIA mind control program, and we've been up to Senator Lee's office a couple of times. There's a couple of other senators, California and Virginia, that are interested. We're trying to get... But we need signatures on the petition. We need several thousand signatures before they'll even talk to us. And so I would really appreciate... And what's interesting about this petition is that there's... We've only had it up a couple of weeks, but we've got over 40 MKUltra CIA mind control survivors that have given comments on the petition. And they're very, very interesting comments to go in and read. The site, again, is childabuserecovery.com, CAR, childabuserecovery.com. Also on that site, there's a history of the CIA mind control program. You can see the videos of these survivors. There's a lot of information on that site. And there's a lot of other information that I don't have time to get to, having to do with Kevin Annette and the Catholic Church and sacrifices that are going on below the Vatican and all that. But you can see some of that information through that site and through some of the Examiner articles that I have. This is another book. It's called Rabbit Hole, and this is a friend of mine, Robert Schuter. It's kind of a follow-up on the Franklin book, but he was an actual survivor during the Omaha experience, during the Boys Town experience, when the CIA and drugs and prostitution at the White House and all that was going on. There's a lot of books out by ritual abuse survivors. They're starting to speak out now, and we're hoping to get the word out. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
I'm Chris Anderson, and is it on? I'm Chris Anderson. I have a little bit different take. I know these ladies on the panel. I love them dearly. We've all been through a lot. In uncovering satanic ritual abuse and bringing it to the forefront, my life's a little bit different. I've had some experiences with Satanism long before it all blew up in my face. And I kept asking, why is this happening? Why are these witnesses coming to me of this darkness? They were unusual. But the one thing that happened is that each time I had the witness, I had two and three follow-ups that quietly within my spiritual development before God, I began to see a pattern. And it prepared me for what then transpired when we started uncovering this satanic occult in a Catholic monastery that had catacombs under it where they raped and pillaged the women and children. We were women. Nobody in the community suspected us. We did not go out and seek it. God had prepared each one of us individually. We just walked the mall and talked at 7 in the morning. We were talking about motherly things, and all of a sudden it began. And it's too long. I could write an 800-page book. But we would get information. We did not run out and tell anybody. We just waited. We'd talk about it when we walked the mall in the morning, but we waited. 2 or 3 days later, there would be an accident in the newspaper, and somebody would come and just innocently talk to us, and we would write these things down. We were told by the Spirit, write it down, write it down, write it down. We became great recorders of all of this information. It was just coming to us. I can't even begin to tell you everything that happened. But through this, we started piecing it together as women, and we're going, oh my goodness, we were just innocent mothers. We thought that men in trucks that were evil and dark raped women. We had no idea about satanic occult stuff. It led to an enormous opening. And I remember thinking one day I was at the kitchen sink and I could feel blood just in my spirit just coming off my body. And I couldn't breathe. I just couldn't breathe. And I said, Father in heaven, if you're there, I need help with this stuff. You have brought it to me, but now I don't know what to do with it. If this is true, help me. And through miracle things, my little girl brought home her new friend, and her new friend was on the phone, and could she come over to our house and play? And I said yes, and her dad got on the phone and said, I know right where you are, and he comes, and this girl's this little beautiful angel, and she comes in our home, and the father's checking me out, and I'm checking him out, and we start to talk, and I said, how did you know where I live? And he says, oh, this is my beat, and my heart sunk. I thought, oh, a policeman, for we had uncovered policemen in this occult stuff. But through it all, he ended up being a good policeman and became our dear friend, and he had another person. And this is how God works. I was told through a voice to tell this policeman everything I knew. I thought, yeah, right. Yeah, right. And he's standing in my living room, and I get hit from behind, and I lunged forward, and I thought it was my 13-year-old boy, Jared, and I whipped around to yell at Jared and say, Jared, and there was nobody there. And I heard these voices say, tell him now. Well, this guy's in my house. I just lunged forward. I whipped around like this, and he's saying, this lady is off her rocker, and I'm going to leave my daughter with her. I'm going somewhere with this. This beautiful little girl comes out, golden hair, and she put her hand in mine, and she said, Daddy, I like this place. This is a heavenly place, and I like Katie. Can she come over and stay overnight at our house? And this policeman knelt down, looked eye to eye to her, and said, Jordan, you know we don't believe in sleepovers. And I thought, this guy couldn't rape his daughter. He doesn't believe in sleepovers. And the voice came again in my ear saying, tell him now. And I said, so you're a policeman? He says, yes. We were on a very special assignment, and we had to get a rest from it, so they put us back in a police car. I said, what was the assignment? And he said, I can't tell you. It was very, very dark. I said, oh. Now, remember, I've got these voices. I've just lunged forward. I've got a little girl holding my hand that's telling me I'm safe with her daddy. And I thought, well, if this is God giving a voice in my ear, I got to listen. So I said to him, do you know anything about the Catholic monastery on Council and Edmund Road? He just about dropped everything. And he said, that's the assignment that my partner and I have been working on for 2 years. Mrs. Anderson, do you know about it? And I said, yes. He said, may I come in and sit down? Now, this is where I'm going with this. It went into the school. The principal of the school was a lady. It went into the gym where they drugged the children and molested them. And then they talk to the children that were hurt, were then told to go to a psychiatrist in Reno who was raised in the occult. It went into the community. It went into the Air Force Base. The sociology counselor was a Satanist who was molesting the children that he was counseling. It went everywhere. And we had all of this information, and now we bring out this notebook that's 5 inches thick, and I handed it to my new friend, and he said, Mrs. Anderson, I want to tell you something. If you came down to the police station tonight, it says above my chair, with God, I can do anything, and without God, I am nothing. Does that help you decide if you can entrust me? Now, here's Jordan holding on to my hand still. She's just this angel of light, which God sent. So this is what I want to tell you tonight. We uncovered some of the worst satanic occult stuff you could ever imagine. They were professional people. There were 58 policemen. There were doctors. There were lawyers. There were morticians. We had help from, but you didn't know who to trust. And so we thought we could blow the whistle. You can't. Because they don't come after me. They'll come after my little girl who's six. And they will rape her and bring split her personalities and bring her back all bathed to me. So we had to guard the school. She could not play outside without me. We had to put our car into the garage so they didn't cut our brake linings. This got huge. One day, the police came, my friends, and said, they're going to kill you tonight. We have to get you out of here. And so I fled to my dear friends in Utah and lived with them and took my precious little girl and came out and got to meet Sharon and these lovely ladies here, and we all began working together. This is what I've learned. The more you try to expose it, the more they'll come back. So you have to be smarter than they. And you do that by righteous living, reading your scriptures, adding light into your life, bearing your witness of God the Father and Jesus Christ. But you move forward in silence. You speak too loud. They've always got a plan to come back and hurt you. So as a crusader of righteousness, and I thought we could go up and do it, we were on the TV, the churches were bombed, the whole nine yards. You have to be very smart when dealing with Satan, and that means you're quiet. Resist not evil. It means put your attention on good. If you go and read these books, then you better read the scriptures as you're reading these books. You need to balance your life out if you want to get into this and know about it. So this is my witness to you. It's real. It truly is real. And may I say two other things? If these were my last dying words of opportunity to give a community of young mothers, I would say to them, do not let your children go out and play all day in the neighborhood in their bathing suit, one piece of fabric. Come on, mothers. children should go to the swimming pool, swim, and then get dressed and come home and play in decent clothes. Be modest with the children. I have my bishop here tonight, so he's going to hear something that just fries me. I pull into our neighborhood, and out there on the main road are children, little five-year-olds going to kindergarten, and they're out there without their mothers. They're alone. It takes a half hour for a Satanist to split a personality. There is a ceremony. They know how to do it, and they're cunning, and they can split the personality and bring that child back and put him right there by the bus stop. And the child knows something's wrong, but he doesn't know what. So he becomes excessive compulsive. He becomes anorexic. He becomes a super achiever. He becomes overweight. And you go through 18 years of their life, and that you don't know what's wrong with them until years later. Protect your children. Protect your wives. And the other thing that I would say is this. If a child comes home, your grandson, your granddaughter, your 13-year-old boy comes home and says, "I don't like this leader in the church. He's the scout leader. I don't have a very good feeling. I don't want to go to meeting next week." What do we do? "Oh, that's brother so-and-so. He's just the neatest man in the whole world, and you should like him, and you need to go to the scout trip." And your child just said, "I don't feel good about this man." Please, please believe the children. Their spirits are pure. They know, they sense it. And you say, "You don't have to be around brother so-and-so or that medical doctor. Or that man down the street, you don't have to be there. I don't want you to be around them unless I'm with you." Those are the two things. Listen to the Spirit of the Lord. Balance your life out with lots of light. And if you think you're going to crusade this, you got to be smarter than the devil. And he's had a million billion years ahead of us. He knows how to do it. So what we have to do is have the light to listen to the voices and know the revelation when it comes. What guided me and kept my friends and I sane was that with every step forward in uncovering this occult, God brought two and three witnesses. And we didn't talk about it. We did not go talking about it. We just wrote it down. And then when it was time to go down to the police department and say, "We want to file charges," the police said, "If these people are guilty, they will remain quiet. But if they are innocent, they will sue the socks off of you. You won't have so much as a penny left to your name. You are dealing with some of the strongest lawyers in this city. Are you women sure, absolutely sure, you know what you're doing?" And because we had witnesses on all of these points, we said to the police, "We are sure." And he said, "You're out of your mind, because you know what's going to happen today? We're going to file these charges, but tomorrow the newspaper is going to get a hold of it, and it's going to hit the papers. And are you prepared for what's going to happen?" So that's what I would like leave you with. It's not easy going up against the occult, I know. I came out here and I've been basically hiding, living quietly. You just have to be smarter than Satan, and I don't know that you can. So you just have to continually add that light so that if the prompting comes to you to do something, then you do it. And if not, you leave it to the experts here that have been through it. You leave it to those who have great knowledge and they're working with it. I think God gave me my assignment because I'm a spitfire and I analyze things and I can be quiet until that moment that he says, "Okay, let the bomb go off." And I have the personality to say, "Okay, I'm ready, let's go." And he used women who the community never suspected. When we blew this thing open, we spread 104 so-called Catholic priests. priests in a Catholic monastery, and they split and went to Florida. Did we get the policemen? No, they're still back there doing their thing. So it goes on. They just move from one city to the next. Because why? Just as you have your testimony of your belief system of God and Jesus Christ or whomever you believe in, they have their belief system and they're willing to die for it. The Satanists are willing to die for what they believe in. So you can spend your time learning everything you can about Satan, or you can spend all your time learning about God the Father and Jesus Christ and good, and allow these experts to continue their work, and we'll pray for you. Thank you.
My name is Brandon Scott, and I've spent years and years of studying and memorizing and studying witchcraft, priestcraft, you name it. And just to add to a few things that have been said here and Brother Bauer's work, in fact, any of you that have pens and pads, you're going to want to write stuff down, because I just start spewing out information and you need to go research this stuff. When we talk about the Freemasons, and back in the 1700s, the family by the name of the Bayers, B-A-Y-E-R, and many of you may know they changed their name to Rothschilds. And so where the money and the funding for all of this came from is from them. There's a gentleman named Adrian Pike, who's a relative of Albert Pike. And Adrian Pike got together with Adam Weitzop and Bayer, and they formulated the Illuminati. And one of his key things that he said is the power. The power in our order lies in its concealment. Never let it be known or seen in any given place more than once at any given time. And their whole goal was to infiltrate. And they take existing organizations and they infiltrate them from the top down. And that's why it has the appearance that, like Brother Bauer said, is that it's good. And it has the appearance of, oh, I know a Mason or this, and it's good. Because they have no clue about what's going on. The Palladian Rite that came about, that's administered in the three Grand Lodges. And it happens, all of these things are symbolic. Satan is the master counterfeiter. And for those who study doctrine and scripture and know the workings of John the Revelator, Nephi said it clearly. He said there's two churches, Church of the Lamb of God, Church of the Devil. That's it. We have to understand that structure. We have to understand that he's a master counterfeiter. And that's exactly what he's done, is he's created that. Albert Pike also was involved heavily with the Ku Klux Klan and was one of the main guys there. He's the only general that has a statue in Washington, D.C. Now, if you study the history, just go Google him and study the history, and you tell me if that man has anything good. Why does he have a statue in Washington, D.C.? There's no reason for that. European Masonry was infiltrated in 1782. American Masonry started to be infiltrated in 1859, which was fully infiltrated by 1870, 1871. And so you say, why? Why is the devil so crafty? Why does he know all these things? Why does he figure these things out? Anybody who's familiar with the Book of Mormon and knows the word secret combination, if you go to that root word, combination, that root word actually means conspiracy. If you go to a Webster's 1828 dictionary, you have to get an 1828 or earlier, because if you get one after it, it won't be in there. And the root word is conspiracy. That's why Ezra Taft Benson in 71 said, there's no conspiracy theory in the Book of Mormon. It's a conspiracy fact. And this is after he just got done basically explaining the whole downfall of the Nephite and the Jaredite civilization. And so if we understand how crafty he is and how he does his work, we can start to put it together. In 1798, there's a book written by John Robison. Everyone needs to Google it. You can get it in PDF. It's 239 pages. It's called Proofs of a Conspiracy. And this is 1798, this book's written. And you can get information out of there that's just, it'll blow your mind. And when we talk about MK Ultra, MK Ultra is a German word, control. K-O-N-T-R-O-L-L-E. It's mind control, and it's German. And the operation that the lady in purple, I'm sorry, I don't know your name, so Judy, okay? She talked about the operation that was going on with the CIA, and it's called Operation Paperclip. Go Google it, go read about it, go research it. Operation Paperclip, there's over 1,800 of the scientists and the people when the Nazi regime fell that the CIA and the government brought them into the United States. They naturalized them, and they put them to work underground for the CIA. And that's what they've done. And you need to get on YouTube. And if the mind control thing, when I first started looking, I'm like, gosh, there's no way this Manchurian candidate stuff. Like, there's no way. This stuff can't be legit, right? But you go and research it. There's a documentary that's done by Darren Brown, and it's called The Experiments of an Assassin. And if you haven't seen that, it's about 47 minutes. And you need to Google it, you need to watch it. And he goes through that and says, look, let me show you how this works. And he just takes people out of the audience, and he's done some research on it. And just from that little experiment, you can see that if you used all kinds of SRA and you used torture and the fear of drowning and everything else, it multiplies that and makes it just more and more intense. And as you study the history of these things and you look back at it and you say, you know, where's the core and where's this real power structure and where's it really coming from? And it all ends up at the same place. And so, you know, the witchcraft, it's all around us. It's everywhere. I mean, I have friends and they've researched this too. And we drive around all the time and we see things and it's the counterfeit. And you say, oh, well, look at that. It's witchcraft. It's in our music. It's in language. These people who write in the music industry, these people, they have lyricists. Not all these people are singer-songwriters. They have lyricists. They write the music for these people, for Guns N' Roses, Axl Rose, for Elton John. There's a guy named Bernie Taupin. There's a guy named Alan McCovey. These are world-renowned lyricists, and these gentlemen belong to the Luciferian Church, the Church of Satan. Anyone in here, by the raise of hand, familiar with the Eagles? Okay, all of their songs are written by these men. There's an album called The Hotel California. That album is laid out and put together in a witchcraft language. And these people who write, these lyricists who are Luciferian, have to learn this language. And there's words that mean certain things. And The Hotel California, has anyone wondered what it is? What's The Hotel California?
Church of Satan.
It's the Church of Satan, and it's on California Street. And it was... one of the big guys' influence was Aleister Crowley. And if any of you don't know who Aleister Crowley is, he's world-renowned Satanist. The Stairway to Heaven, that song by Led Zeppelin, was written in his mansion in England. And Jimmy Page says, we just picked up the pencil and the lyrics wrote themselves. So what I'm saying is as we look into these things and we start to see... and we see this world out there, you know, my favorite quote is a man or a woman, for that matter, reaches total enlightenment when he wakes up and realizes that everything is illusion. And that's what we're living in. We're living in this grand deception and this master lie where we've fallen into the traditions of our fathers, which are not correct. And we always say, oh, no, it's not us. It's not us. It's not us. No way. There's no way I could be deceived by that. No way. But that's what we're living in. We're living in a big, giant cauldron of lies, and we've been fed these lies. One of my favorite men, David O. McKay and J. Reuben Clark, both said that we're living in the greatest era of propaganda the world's ever seen. And it really is that. It's what Brother Bowers quoted at the first here, J. Edgar Hoover, and his statement. He said, the American people will become handicapped face to face with a conspiracy so big and so large and so monstrous, they won't even believe that it exists when they're confronted with it. And that's what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years that this has been put. This goes back all the way to the 1400s, and it's a bloodline. It's there's these people are families and their bloodlines, and it involves incest and it involves satanic things. And once you can get your mind wrapped around that and understand it, you can start to see through the matrix of things that we live in. And I'll just end with that.
I just wanted to add a couple of little things. He talked about Pike. Pike was head of one of the congressional committees in 1977 when all the information was hung up. It was called the Pike Committee. And Roseanne Barr is a very big advocate of mind control victims, and she is a multiple personality herself. And she talks about the Hollywood connection to the MK Ultra. And Aleister Crowley was a Hitler's people studied Aleister Crowley's, and that's what the people that came into the United States, the Nazis, were using this Aleister Crowley's information when they set up the mind control program.
Which Aleister Crowley, by the way, is the Google that and have fun with that one.
Okay.
And the one other thing I wanted to say was that this all comes down from pagan worship. And there's a pagan tribe called the Quintus tribe who claimed to be the descendants of Cain. And that was by Flavius Josephus is a Jewish historian in the first century. He writes about the pagan Quintus tribe being descendants of Cain.
I'd like to invite us all to give the panel and Brother Bowers a well done applause. Thank you. Due to the lateness of the hour, I think we probably maybe just ought to forego the questions, right? Because it's pretty late. But by show of hands, though, how many of you would like or feel like you might be interested in maybe a part two on this, another Friday or maybe perhaps on a Saturday? Anybody interested in that at all? Okay. Dan, I'm going to let you set that one up. So we'll get you. We'll contact you by email. You know when that'll be. We'll coordinate it, and these fine ladies we'll set that up. So, are we okay? If we do the questions another time. This is so late. Okay. So we're gonna play Sharon's song. After which we'd like to ask Bryce and Jack to.
The other thing too, when you talked earlier, there's a documentary. Good documentary.
It corroborates what the book that we were talking to you about earlier. Okay, Bryce, would you give us a closing prayer after the song? Okay. So hang with us for a couple more minutes for this song from Sherry. And then, once again, thank you all for coming. We have a meeting next month. It'll be the first Friday in December. We'll send you out an email on that. And then, thanks again for coming and appreciate your support.